You may be seated. Our next case is 14-735 CK versus the State of Ohio. Have you moved?
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice.
Counsel.
Brian Gutkowski, on behalf of the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office, I represent the State of Ohio. I'd request 3 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. CK asked for a judicial rewrite of the fourth prong of the wrongful imprisonment statute and asked this court to essentially overrule Gover. We'd ask that you reject each of those choices and instead hold that under 2743.48A4, a claimant must prove that no further criminal prosecution can be brought for any act associated with his or her conviction. A claimant whose criminal case remains open under investigation and in which the criminal statute of limitations has not expired is unable to satisfy the fourth prong of that statute. Now, in the facts of the case below, the criminal transcript is in the record. Mr. CK lost his job at Sprint in approximately spring of 2008. The following year, his residence on Cherokee Avenue in Collinwood's neighborhood.
Counsel, we know the facts, but I guess I'm troubled by what the Court of Appeals said. The reality is, you can charge him tomorrow, can you not?
Well, again, the acts associated with this particular crime were dismissed without prejudice. That's unequivocal. And yes, you're absolutely right. The crime of murder has no statute of limitations, Justice O'Neill, so that is a possibility. And in fact, the prosecutor at his sealing hearing said on the record that, it's a possibility. You're right. So again, getting back to the facts of the case, he had no job, he was unemployed, he decided to rent out rooms in his home to various people in the neighborhood. In the record, it states that he would charge $10 a day to two people, in this case, Mr. Coleman and...
Counsel, again, I don't want to be argumentative this morning, but we know the facts. The facts aren't real important in this case. The question is the public policy that if you have from now until time immemorial to file the charge, this individual can never benefit from the statute, can he?
Well, this individual avoided a conviction under the Eighth District's interpretation of the Castle Doctrine as applied to the facts of this case, Justice O'Neill.
He didn't avoid a conviction. The Court of Appeals reversed the conviction.
Right. It was found sitting as the 13th juror under a manifest.
Why do you call that a void?
Well, that's what an affirmative defense is. It's I committed the act, but I'm justified, and that's what the Eighth District found in their opinion reversing.
Is that the law of the case?
No, Justice.
I'm O'Donnell.
O'Donnell, thank you.
She's O'Connor.
And I'm O'Neill.
It's not the law of the case. This court has repeatedly stated that this particular proceeding for Mr. CK is separate and distinct from the underlying finding of guilt. But nonetheless, the facts are certainly at issue as were presented before the jury in the criminal proceedings.
Is the appellate court decision with reference to the application of the Castle Doctrine the law of the case?
No. I would argue that the Eighth District's prior opinion reversing his conviction is not law of the case, again, because this court has specifically stated that in, I believe, Iran Doss, that the there's no preclusive effect of a prior acquittal or a prior reversal in the criminal proceedings. Nonetheless, certainly the facts as were presented.
Well, I don't think that's what Justice O'Donnell is asking you. He's asking you if you were to recharge and retry based on the Court of Appeals decision, the Castle Doctrine would be a defense that this particular individual would conclusively be entitled to present in this case.
I don't think that would necessarily prevent the
Why
prosecution
not?
from going forward.
Well, no. That's not the question of whether you could go forward. I think the question is the defense would conclusively have the Castle Doctrine in the case.
Well, hypothetically, right? Additional facts could come to light, which may in fact negate application of the Castle Doctrine. Justice Pfeiffer, the Castle Doctrine isn't a license to kill. The Castle Doctrine is simply a rebuttable presumption that, in fact, reasonable means to expel an intruder were employed. And in this case, there's evidence in the record that Mr. Coleman was renting at Mr. CK's house for $10 a day. He may have been asked to leave prior to this incident, but nonetheless, the jury heard about this, and the jury of 12 came to a unanimous decision convicting Mr. CK of murder. He was sentenced to 15 years in prison, 3 years on the gun spec. That decision of 12 people that was unanimously entered was discarded on appeal. But nonetheless, again, additional facts could come to light which may in fact negate the application of the Castle Doctrine. So that the
But Mr. Gutkowski, the situation here is the state is not going to retry him, it looks like. I mean, my concern is that by just saying dismissal without prejudice, as Justice O'Neill is suggesting, that wipes out the possibility of any type of use of the wrongful imprisonment statute. And that's what you're saying, that the state has utter control by using those words, dismissal without prejudice.
Well, yes, that's essentially what we are saying. In the case of murder, there is no applicable statute of limitations on that offense. Therefore, when the prosecutor on remand says, I'm dismissing this without prejudice, and there's no objection, and the court, in fact, orders a dismissal without prejudice, that, in fact, would bar relief for a claimant under A4.
And there was no objection here, you're saying?
No, the court's order was unequivocal. The case is dismissed without prejudice. And to my knowledge, there was no objection to that dismissal being entered. Therefore, because, you know, Ohio's prosecutors are tasked with a difficult choice. I mean, they have to pursue justice. And, you know, we entrust them with decisions, charging decisions for indictments, and we also entrust them with whether or not to make certain legal arguments like the prosecutor is in this case, specifically telling Mr. CK, you know what, I'm going to reserve the right to reindict you.
Counsel, this is 5 years ago, right?
That's correct, Justice.
All right, so you've had this case for 5 years. Whatever scientific advances, I mean, there is no scientific advances that you need in order to prosecute this case. You're looking for possibly some other witness, but it was only really the young lady, CK, and Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Coleman, who's deceased.
Correct.
Right.
Those are the three people on the premise.
Right. Those are the three people in the room when the shots, six of them, were fired into Mr. Coleman.
Right. And there's no argument that he was beating on Miss McNaughton, correct?
Well, yes, he did, in fact, show up there seeking more either crack cocaine or more money to purchase crack cocaine. And
he was not welcome in the home.
Well, he had been previously asked to leave and did so. But again, it's undisputed that he had previously stayed there. He was the ex-boyfriend of Miss McNaughton.
Right, but he had no right to enter the home. That was what the court found.
That's what the 8th District found.
Yes, okay. And so here we are, fast forward 5 years. And the state of Ohio has done absolutely nothing in 5 years.
Well, at this time, the case does remain open, subject to investigation. And
who's investigating it?
To my knowledge, I don't know that.
There's no activity on this.
More likely than not, correct.
You're right. Okay, so you're just having, this case is literally in limbo. There is absolutely nothing that has transpired or likely to transpire.
Well, again, subject to additional evidence coming to light, the prosecutor does reserve the right to reindict. And, you know, notwithstanding the arguments about can be brought under A4.
So is your strategy wait for this guy to get in trouble again, and then we'll drag this one up and charge him with both and use that as a hammer to bargain the next case? Is that?
I don't know if there's any strategy in effect, Justice Pfeiffer, but again, nonetheless, completely setting aside the arguments about can be brought and the plain statutory text of A4, this court in the 1993 case of Gover held that contemporaneous criminal conduct, in fact, also is a disqualifying factor under the fourth prong of the wrongful imprisonment statute. And again, it's undisputed that in the record, when the investigating officers obtained a warrant to search Mr. CK's house, they found evidence of crack cocaine use. They found pipettes used for smoking crack cocaine.
But counsel, isn't that contrary to the statute? where the statute says arising out of the conduct or associated with his other conviction. So how would that other possible criminal activity be arising out of what he had been in prison for?
Well, I would argue in counter to that, Justice French, that you know, if we want to look to conduct arising out of the original conviction, that you know, Andre Coleman, when CK showed him the weapon that he was holding, put his hands up, again, undisputed, that he had powder burns on his hands, and that he was shot at least two times in the back. The medical examiner testified that two of the bullets went through the back and through his torso. Again, that seems to me like contemporaneous criminal conduct. I don't know what you want
counsel,
to call it.
Again, I I'm trying not to be argumentative, but I think we're back in law school today, because I'm reading from the 8th District Court of Appeals, quoting the 8th District Court of Appeals. And they're saying, reviewing the evidence, this court found that CK, quote, established all three elements of the affirmative defense of self-defense. Castro and the Castle Doctrine fully applies to the facts of the instant case, okay? Now, I'm sure I really would like to use your time to hear you tell Justice O'Donnell why that is not the law of this case.
Because this court has repeatedly held that a wrongful imprisonment determination is a civil case, and that it is the original exoneration or conviction, whichever the case may be, is not to be given any preclusive effect on the subsequent civil case.
I fully understand that, but you will agree that from the theory of res judicata, there is no possibility that this individual can be tried on this set of facts.
I would disagree with that, Justice O'Neill. I would disagree with that premise.
And don't you have to make that factual finding? For me, this is kind of a procedural question. You essentially have to overcome summary judgment. And you have to show, even your proposition says, a claimant whose criminal case remains open, under investigation, and where the statute of limitations hasn't expired. So your affidavit doesn't do that. The affidavit just says it was dismissed without prejudice. Did you make a factual finding at the trial court to meet all of those, that it's open and it's under investigation?
I believe we did, Justice French. I believe there's an affidavit attached to our summary judgment motion filed in the trial court from the assistant county prosecutor.
I have it. And number 14 just says elected to dismiss, which remains open without prejudice to refiling or re-indicting.
Well, it's axiomatic that something that's dismissed without prejudice can be brought in a future proceeding.
But it doesn't meet your own proposition of law. Your proposition of law says it's open and it's under investigation, and the statute of limitations still remains open. So I guess maybe I'm back to where the Chief Justice was. It's not under investigation. You haven't made that factual finding. So the only thing we're relying on is it's still open because the statute of limitations hasn't run.
Essentially, you know, again, the county prosecutor's office isn't necessarily, totally setting aside cases that are murders that it believes a wrongful death occurred. Assuming additional evidence were to come in, that case would be reevaluated.
Was he prosecuted for the drug paraphernalia that was found in his home?
Of course not. No.
Pardon me?
No, of course not. He was charged with murder, so they weren't going to also indict him for the contemporaneous drug paraphernalia that was charged.
Why not?
Certainly because they had him indicted for murder, Justice O'Connor.
Well, that doesn't make any sense. We're going to give you a pass on drug activity because we've got a bigger charge? You know, what happens if the murder didn't hold up as we have? You would have had the conviction for drug paraphernalia or whatever you found in his home.
I can't necessarily state as to why the underlying drug evidence was not charged in the indictment. Nonetheless, based on the facts that are undisputed in this case, reasonable minds can come to but one conclusion, and that's adverse to Mr. C.K. And if there's no further questions, I'll reserve the balance.
I have one question before you sit down. I believe your opposing counsel urged that in the proceeding before Judge David Mattia, the prosecutors there said there were no plans to indict CK. Well, so when we hear from them that the state doesn't even intend to do this, what is your position with respect to that?
My position is that that's not accurate the actual transcript that was said of the proceedings before Judge Mattia, as I alluded to, is in the record, and the assistant county prosecutor that argued against his record being sealed did not say that there's no plans to bring an indictment again. That's just not in the transcript. She specifically states that he could be charged in the future, Your Honor.
So that's an erroneous argument.
Exactly, Justice.
Did she say something like, not at this time? We're not going to indict at this time?
My review of the transcript at the sealing hearing, Justice O'Connor, there's nothing like that in the record. So
thank you.
Thank you.
Chief Justice, may it please the court, William Eady from the Spangenberg Law Firm on behalf of the plaintiff appellee CK. I'd like to direct you to the record, item 30, the transcript of that hearing, where the court asked, this is Judge Mattia, who presided over both criminal trials. The first criminal trial ended in a mistrial. The second criminal trial ended in a conviction that was overturned by the 8th District. The court asked, thank you. Okay, Ms. Smolanic, that's the prosecutor representative. First question, does the state intend to ever reindict CK for this offense? Ms. Smolanic, not at this time.
And so what page was that?
That's on page 5. It's the plaintiff's supplemental authority in the underlying motion for summary judgment practice. It's record 30. It's the transcript of April 16, 2013. She does follow up, but it could in the future. So do you have any intention at this time to do something? No, I could have an intention in the future. Well, there's not a more concrete way to say, I don't have any intention to do this. And a hope
she
or a
dream. She reserves for future. Let's not parse words here. She says, not at this time, but I'm going to reserve that for the future. That's not your strongest suit.
Well, what I'd like to step back to then is where that fits into in context of the wrongful imprisonment. And the General Assembly says when interpreting these statutes, look at the context the words and phrases are used and use the common usage. And so I want to use a common example. We have school kids watching the argument today. If a teacher says, I need a parent to accompany, transport, chaperone some school children, the parent can answer basically three ways. I can, and I will. I can, but I won't. Or I can't. And in the common usage, we would understand that those last two answers are different. I could, but I won't. Or I can't. But they lead to the same result. So too in the wrongful imprisonment statute language when it says any criminal proceeding can be brought or will be brought. The same answers apply. Either they can be brought and they will, they can be brought and they won't, or they can't be brought at all.
Or it's too early to determine.
Well, in terms of the criminal matter, nothing that the court does in the wrongful imprisonment civil case will have a preclusive effect on a later conviction. Now, I think after 5 years and the type of findings that the 8th District made and the record that's before you supporting that 8th District's determination, it's clear that there is no basis for recharging. Not only was the intruder not permitted, he physically kicked out a wooden door panel on the back door of CK's house and crawled in, was told to leave, left, breaks back in a second time, is told to leave and that the police are coming, breaks in a third time, and starts violently assaulting a tenant at CK's house. And what the 8th District found was that it was clear that not only was CK defending himself and the tenant, but that under the newly passed at that time Castle Doctrine, he had every right to use force in that situation. And that's really where the underlying criminal case went awry. And so when the state asks you to create a bright line rule that they're asking you to create today, the bright line rule is if you were wrongfully convicted, you're actually innocent, but you're wrongfully convicted of murder, and the statute of limitations therefore never expires, you cannot be wrongfully imprisoned, and yet the words murder and statute of limitations don't appear in the statutory language, not once. What does appear is cannot bring criminal proceedings or will not, and we know that that can't be a literal cannot because prosecutors have unfettered authority to charge anyone anytime, and that's why we have cases involving double jeopardy, where someone has been charged despite the fact that there isn't a basis because of double jeopardy, statute of limitations violations. I've represented someone who's charged on a drug crime after 13 years when the statute's 6. So it's clear it can't be a literal cannot. It has to be what the 8th District and the 10th District found, which is that that cannot has to be there's some legal factual basis for bringing it. the bright line rule of statute of limitations expires just doesn't answer that question. It's not in the statute. It doesn't answer the question of whether someone can or bring will bring charges. And importantly here, the evidence is they won't.
Is it your view that CK is actually innocent?
That is absolutely correct.
Based on what?
Based on the fact that he had a license to use that gun, he was in his own home, a drug-addled, violent, convicted murderer kicked in his door and started savagely attacking somebody. And this is about a month after the General Assembly decided, if you're in your home, you don't have to retreat. So what the state is asking you to do is say, well, the General Assembly never meant to cover somebody like this.
And the number of shots fired, 6 shots, 2 in the back, if I understand it correctly, that has nothing to do with the crime committed?
Well, I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that this whole execution theme that the state has presented is based on McNaughton's testimony. She testified twice. In the first trial, she testified there were 6 shots in rapid succession. Their neighbor, testified 6 shots in rapid succession. In the second trial, after a mistrial, after some Ms. McNaughton has admitted she went back to the home and stole video cameras. There's testimony that she confessed to a friend that she went back and stole a gun Mr. Coleman did have and sold it and was involved in a drug crime in between the shooting and the second trial. That's the only evidence in the record is her testimony that only in the second trial, Mr. Kozlowski ran over and Mr. CK ran over and shot in the back. And what that indicates is that when you're reviewing these factual findings and weighing this evidence, or when on remand the trial court is able to weigh that evidence, because the trial court never got to weighing the evidence, what you'll see is that there is no basis in fact to support that testimony over both CK's testimony, the neighbor's testimony, and the basic facts of the case, that if you're entitled to use deadly force, you're entitled to use deadly force.
Counsel, again, I'm getting weighed down by facts here, and I would like to talk about the law. How do you feel about the concept of double jeopardy? I still don't understand how we have a second trial when the 8th District Court of Appeals said Castle Doctrine applies, not guilty.
Second trial occurred prior to the appeal, so it was
I mean the new trial that is being hung in the wind, that maybe sometime in the future we're going to have another trial.
I don't think CK can be tried. I don't think...
Why not?
CK will be tried.
Why can he not be tried?
Because he had the right to defend himself in his home when somebody, a violent felon on drugs, broke into his home and assaulted a tenant, and then...
So you're saying that is the law of this case?
Well, I'd suggest it is the law of the case in the sense that, as Judge Mattia found, the same judge who presided over the criminal conviction was willing to seal CK's record. That same judge said if he could have reversed this and dismissed it with prejudice, he would have. He couldn't. All he could do was seal the record, but say on the record that anyone of any intellectual honesty would admit that CK could not be retried successfully on this record. And so where we are is in that limbo state that was alluded to, where this...
But you're throwing a new word into the statute, successfully.
Well, it can be or will be. And so the question is, has CK produced evidence that, in fact, more likely than not, because this is a civil standard, more likely than not, there will be no more criminal proceedings. And I think an on-the-record in-court statement that we have no plans to reindict this person... the 8th District's findings, the underlying factual record.
There was a reservation by the prosecutor, so you can't ignore that in that discussion with Judge Mattia. And, you know, quite frankly, this is a policy decision to be made by the legislature, and they put these words in a statute. And as much as you may think they're unfair applying them to your client, or we may have those same sentiments, that's not what the statute says. So if the legislature wants to modify the statute and put a time limit of some type in here, that there has to be a retrial within X amount of days or years or whatever, you know, that's up to the legislature. But to ask us to then have a crystal ball and figure out what the prosecutor is going to do, and if they don't do it, and what amounts to a reasonable time, it's been 5 years, then we're going to say, okay, he gets the benefit of the statute. I'm not sure that this court has the authority to do that because it's not spelled out in the statute.
Allow me to respond to that point directly. The statute doesn't say statute of limitations has expired. It doesn't say dismissed with prejudice. It doesn't say wasn't someone charged with murder. It includes none of those terms. So in terms of rewriting the statute, the bright line the state is asking to write would be inventing out of whole cloth this argument about statutes of limitations. What is in the statute is that no criminal proceeding can or will be. And in going back to that common example, can do something but won't is different than can't do something. And so what the 8th and 10th districts have done is proposed a rule that I think is following the text of the statute by saying either you can't do it because there's no factual or legal predicate for doing it. One example of that would be the statute of limitations has expired and there's no reasonable tolling basis. I mean, if you actually took the state's position and made that rule, it wouldn't work because there are plenty of times when people can be tried after the statute of limitations because there's some tolling of the statute. Maybe they flood the jurisdiction. Second, the will not. If you just say the bright line rule is the state decided in its infinite decision-making authority and power to dismiss you your case with prejudice as opposed to without, then you're ignoring and making meaningless the can but won't element of this. And that's what the state has done throughout, is ignored the will not. There can't
we
be
know that we have a jury that convicted CK, correct?
We do.
And the Castle Doctrine was part of that trial.
It was, but it was recently passed. There's about a 30-page digression in the transcript about how to instruct on it, who has the presumption.
So the fact is the case was tried, but the jury rejected it and returned a verdict of guilty.
And what the 8th District found twice now is that, in very compelling language, found that the facts, reviewing as a juror and construing the evidence in a light favorable to the state, there is no way that this jury understood the law and didn't lose its way in applying the Castle Doctrine because the facts are so clear. I mean, imagine.
So if the case were reindicted and retried, and hypothetically a guilty verdict were returned, what do you expect would occur at that point?
Well, initially, I don't think that's going to happen. But if it did happen, I think he would win the case. He'd welcome it, frankly. This is something he's still dealing with today. He'd welcome that opportunity. We've invited that opportunity. And we served discovery asking, is there any investigation? For the first time today, we've actually heard the admission there isn't. But what's important to note is that if you're using that to rely on the cannot, then it doesn't matter that this is murder. It doesn't matter this is no statute of limitations. It doesn't matter what the crime is. The prosecutor can always indict anyone. The prosecutor could indict somebody, as they did in a case I represented, 13 years after an act for a crime that's 6 years statute of limitations. And that person went to jail and sat in jail until the appellate court reversed it. So initiating criminal proceedings, that's the language, not charging and convicting and trying. Just criminal proceedings can be brought. If you interpret that here to mean, well, they could charge him, well, that's true in every case. It just doesn't
stand to reason. Is a subsequent murder indictment in this case subject to a motion to dismiss?
What I can tell you is that after the conviction, after the remand from the reversal of the 8th District, the prosecution, without hesitation, dismissed the case. And I can tell you, I wasn't criminal counsel in that case, but criminal counsel wasn't arguing with the fact that their client who'd been convicted of murder.
Try to focus on what I'm asking you.
I'm sorry if I missed the point.
Is a subsequent indictment in this case subject to a motion to dismiss, in your view?
Absolutely.
Based on what?
I think it should be dismissed based on the 8th District's findings in this case. What's important to note, though, even if it's not, even if it continues, that's not unusual for a case that ends up being reversed or a case that, I mean, the fact that prosecution can wave their wand and prosecute a case, whether the case is disposed of on early motion practice, on a summary judgment or Rule 50, if it's disposed of on appeal, the fact is they can initiate criminal proceedings. They can, in the impossible sense. Is it possible or impossible?
Well, that's what the statute language says. And you're asking us to then parse the word can be brought and go with your three examples about what that means. I can, but I won't. That doesn't say that. I mean, the statute doesn't. Section 4 says the individual's conviction was vacated, dismissed, or reversed on appeal, the prosecuting attorney in the case cannot or will not seek any further appeal of right or upon leave of the court, and no criminal proceeding is pending, can be brought or will be brought by any prosecuting attorney, city law director, etc. Those are the words of the statute. They are unambiguous. And yes, there is no criminal proceeding pending at this point, but it can be brought. Or, not and it will be brought, it says or will be brought by the prosecuting attorney. So you can't read those in conjunction with one another, that both have to apply. It is can be brought, and those are the words of the legislatures.
May I respond briefly?
Sure.
If you accept the state's bright line rule, can be brought means absolute, whether it's possible or impossible. What meaning is there in the phrase or will be brought? Because there's no situation where something will be brought but cannot be brought. So,
but Mr. Eady, in this situation, we're talking about whether CK should obtain compensation for time in prison. In a situation where the state agrees with what the Court of Appeals did, I mean, there's some distinctions here in the way the two of you have talked about the underlying facts of the case. When the state understands that, the state could say dismissal with prejudice, and then we have four absolutely applying. But this is the situation where you've got the murder, the statute of limitations, and the reservation of rights all together in this particular case, which forecloses the compensation.
And I'd like to draw your attention to the appellant's brief at 19. If an individual was truly innocent, so we're talking about an innocent person, the prosecution has discretion to determine whether that individual is entitled to compensation. That's not in the statute. This is a civil claim that CK and every other claimant has to go before a court, and the court makes these determinations. And it's critical to note the element isn't cannot be brought, it's cannot be brought or will not. And that has to have a meaning. Under the statutory construction, RC 1.47B, you have to presume the whole statute has meaning. I mean, I'm telling people who know better than anybody. That or will be brought simply doesn't have meaning if
we
accept the state's
brought.
Rule.
It can be brought or will be brought by the prosecuting attorney. Something can be brought and the prosecutor, for whatever reason, decides not to bring it.
That's this case. That's this case. At worst case scenario, that's this case. I would suggest
but
it cannot
really
be brought.
But not according to the prosecutor. You're saying that the facts would lead you to say, conclude that it will not be brought. But the prosecutor, and in the transcript before Judge Mattia, reserve the right to do so, and you're ignoring that part of the evidence that is in the record.
Well, I would just point out that when opposing counsel stood up and said open under investigation statute of limitations, there's no evidence in the record this is under investigation. He admitted it's not under investigation.
Well, there's such a thing as cold cases that are resurrected at all the time, so I'm not going to get into the the protocol within the police department or the prosecuting attorneys. That's not what's on trial here, or was on trial, and that's not what's being appealed here. So it's the plain language of the statute is what is being appealed.
And counsel, just to clarify on that point of the transcript you've attached here was that's with Judge Mattia, but the wrongful imprisonment case isn't with Judge Mattia, it's Judge Clancy.
And I think there's one section in the brief where we cite to our appendix, when in fact what we should cite to is record 30. So the record documents 30 is plaintiff's supplemental authority in support of the motion for summary judgment below in the trial court level. And we attach that as an exhibit in support of the summary judgment. And that's where the prosecutor says, when asked, does the state intend to ever reindict Mr. Kozlowski? They say not at this time, but it could in the future, Your Honor. Well, that's true in every case, whether
it's
murder.
That's in front of Judge Clancy.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I'm sorry. That's in front of Judge Mattia. I'm sorry. You're correct.
That's your first representation. It was Judge Mattia.
Correct.
Okay, and you're sticking with it.
I am.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've used your time.
Thank you. Just briefly, Justice O'Neill, it can be brought again because the 8th District, in its opinion that you were quoting from, reluctantly remanded pursuant to a manifest weight analysis that enables the prosecution to bring a future indictment. This court has, from Walden to Manzeray, always interpreted this statute very narrowly. And my colleague on the other side thinks that this enables the prosecutors to hold people that were exonerated in murder proceedings a wild card over their head so that they can't, and no prosecutor in their right mind would ever consent to wrongful imprisonment compensation. Well, contrary to that representation, our office just did. Mr. Bridgman, Mr. Jackson, and another person just received money. The prosecution entered a stipulation and said we're not going to pursue this case, and they, I believe, just received a couple checks from the court.
Well, wasn't there conclusive DNA?
In that, the Bridgman case, they were there was a recantation by a 15-year-old witness, and the prosecutor said we're not going to.
But in the in Jackson, wasn't there? What was it that changed the outcome?
The fact of the matter was that the prosecutor, in his discretion, said we're not going to pursue any sort of future proceedings in this, and the prosecutors are, you know, equipped to make those calls to pursue justice. So,
but counsel, did the prosecutor say it in this case? I know we've heard what was said in front of Judge Mattia. I'm only looking at the affidavit that was submitted to Judge Clancy. Before Judge Clancy, did the prosecutor say, this is open, but we may indict this person, we may re-indict? I'm still struggling after all this. I don't know what evidence the prosecutor has put forward. Is it only the affidavit, or was there more?
Well, the affidavit was in the record. The certified copies of the transcript that indicated the dismissal was without prejudice. You know, beyond that,
certified copy of the
criminal proceedings
before criminal. Judge Mattia, in which the prosecutor said, not at this time, but we might in the future.
Correct.
And that is, Judge Clancy had
Judge
that
Clancy.
To look at.
Yes, to my knowledge, she did.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'd ask that the decision be reversed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Thank you.